Planet 9 from outer space, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome to the travel show that takes you to the final frontier. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society. What a show we have for you this week, headlined by a conversation with Mike Brown and Constantine Batygin, the guys who have pointed the way to what is likely our solar system's ninth planet, one that won't get demoted. The world has beat a path to Emily Lakdawalla's door for a look at spectacular images from China's moon lander and rover. Bill Nye is making waves, gravity waves, and he'll salute another fallen Apollo hero. Lots of surprises from our What's Up segment, including the first talking answer to the space trivia contest. Here's the Planetary Society's senior editor. Emily, you've, as usual, got lots for us to look at in the blog at planetary.org, but I'm going to stretch back a couple of weeks to a piece you posted about a certain Chinese lunar mission, which has attracted an enormous amount of attention. Tell us about this.
Yeah, well, a Chinese researcher alerted me to the fact that some data had been released from the Chang'e 3 mission. This was the lander mission with the U2 rover. I had not known of any release of science data before. They'd released lots of photos from the mission, but this was an actual science data release with like all of the images from a certain stretch of time with all the metadata and other header information that you need in order to figure out how to assemble all the images together. It was really awesome. And so I did what I usually do, which is to download a whole lot of data and try to understand it. And I made a browse page to it. But then I realized that there's a lot of American researchers who aren't permitted to access Chinese servers for data. And so I thought, what if I provided a public service by hosting all of the original data on the Planetary Society's data server and allowing people to download it from there? And people seem to like that.
This was an enormous amount of work. I mean, it sounds like you worked on this for the better part of a week or maybe an entire week, but it has really paid off. According to our colleagues, you may have reached at least a potential audience of 162 million people online, everywhere from Gizmodo to Huffington Post Japan to Fox News Online. This has really been picked up by everybody.
I just think it's kind of amusing because it's, after all, data that was public. It was out there. All I needed was some researcher to point me to it. But nobody'd ever done a press release. It wasn't part of the usual rounds of information getting out there. And so it became this huge surprise to everybody that this data was available. And a lot of people assumed that this was the first release ever of Chinese data. And, well, that's not true. It was actually released on a website that I'd written about years before when they released data from their two lunar orbiter missions. So it's something they've been doing for a long time.
Before we go, do you have any favorites among these images? There are some beauties here.
It's all really beautiful. I, of course, love images of hardware on the moon. Probably my very favorite one is the image taken by the U2 rover showing the Chang'e 3 lander in the distance against the horizon. I just think it's very evocative seeing that safe lander off in the distance, and the rover was ready to go off on an adventure. Unfortunately, 2 days after taking that photo, the rover's motor controller failed and it stayed where it was.
Well, thanks to Emily, all of this stuff is much more easily available. You can start with her blog entry that she posted on January 29th, Fun with a New Data Set, Chang'e Lander and U2 Rover Camera Data. While you're there, you'll see her piece also looking back at images taken of Curiosity from high overhead by the high-rise camera, some spectacular surroundings, terrain that rover is having to traverse. Emily, thank you very much for all of this.
Thank you, Matt.
She's our senior editor, planetary evangelist for the Planetary Society, and a contributing editor to Sky and Telescope magazine. Bill Nye is the CEO of the Planetary Society. We'll hear from him now. Big news out of physics this week, Bill. This is such a huge story. I'm glad you want to talk about it.
Space physics here on Earth. So Einstein and everybody figured that since light can be thought of as a wave, electricity can be thought of as a wave. Energy moves in waves. Doesn't gravity move in waves? Sure, we can't feel it because these things would be so tiny. But as you may know, people set up the old LIGO, Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. It's these huge things out in the desert, these long beams of lasers in tunnels. And the idea is if a wave of gravity goes past us, these mirrors at each end of these long tubes will move just a little. And the thing is, if we found these waves, it would verify a lot of enormous ideas in science and physics. And they say, Matt, they're going to make the big announcement at Columbia University during this week. Ooh.
Now, we should say, we don't know. Maybe they'll say they didn't find them, but it is looking...
Fine, Matt. Have it your way. Yeah, you're right. But it could be a cool thing. It's like when people detected the Higgs boson. You had to look at the data carefully to convince yourself that it was there. And I guess these guys will.
Before I let you go, I want to get your thoughts, words about the passing of another pioneer, another explorer of space, Edgar Mitchell, the lunar module pilot in Apollo 14, just passed away.
Everybody, our hero Neil Armstrong, puts the lunar module on the moon's surface, and Apollo 12 is successful. And Apollo 13, almost everybody gets killed. Almost. Ed Mitchell was the pilot on the one after that. And there was a lot of anxiety about, was this going to work? Is he going to be able to pull it off? Is this going to be a disaster or a huge success? And it was a huge success. It's just the end of an era, Matt, or another step in the end of an era where the guys who first walked on the moon are not living anymore. It's just have to honor his memory. And I'll say again, as I so often say, and of course I was born in the U.S., I don't know any better, but NASA is the best brand the United States has. And the accomplishment of putting people on the moon is still stands as one of a great moment in history for humankind. And Ed Mitchell was a big part of it. Let's celebrate his life.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Thank you, Matt.
He's the CEO of the Planetary Society, Bill Nye, the science guy. We are a few moments away from a great conversation with the Planet Nine boys, Mike Brown and Constantine Batygin. It has only been a few weeks since our world, well, actually our solar system, was shaken by two scientists at the California Institute of Technology. The title of their paper says it all, Evidence for a Distant Giant Planet in the Solar System. Mike Brown and Constantine Batygin have been global celebrities ever since. Mike has been through this before. After all, he's the discoverer of many distant objects, and he wrote How I Killed Pluto and Why It Had It Coming. When the media celebrated Constantine in the past, it was generally for his rock band, not his astrophysics. I recently brought the planetary radio microphones to Mike Brown's office for the conversation you're about to hear. The three of us sat at the desk where Mike and Constantine developed their strong evidence for the still unseen Planet Nine, following in the footsteps of earlier astronomers who pointed the way to far closer Neptune and even Pluto. Mike and Constantine believe this big new world is also out there waiting to be imaged, though it may be so far from the sun that a single orbit lasts 20,000 of our earthly years. Mike, Constantine, thank you so much, and congratulations on this, I think I'll call it a discovery, even though it hasn't been seen yet. Okay with you?
Well, thanks, Matt, but I think it'll be a discovery when it gets caught on camera.
Okay.
Well, yeah, I agree with that one.
Yeah, our work will turn into a discovery from a prediction.
We'll talk about that and how close we're getting to it and the worldwide search that I think you guys have instigated. Have things quieted down? The paper at least came out on January 14th. I know it's been a whirlwind since then, right?
It has been, and we still get... I don't know how many emails and letters a day on naming suggestions and how to find it suggestions and everything else. But it's calming down enough that we can actually get back to work, which is actually finding Planet Nine, which is what we're working on hard right now.
You want to do science still after this?
We do, yeah. Actually.
Okay. Well, I think you did even after you killed Pluto, so why not stick with what you know? This is newer for you than it is for Mike, this kind of attention, isn't it?
Well... Yeah, I mean, this has been a bit overwhelming, and you know, I've actually been sort of humbled a bit by the extent to which this paper has captivated the imagination of the public. I mean, when we were writing this paper, we were just writing a paper. We were writing the results of our calculations. It was not anything more than that. I mean, we found it to be immensely exciting. But this has been really fantastic, and the number of downloads is huge, which I think means that some people outside of the scientific community are actually reading the paper, which is more than you can ask
for. Or at least downloading the paper. That's right. I'm not sure they're reading it.
I'm sure they're going through the Hamiltonian. Yeah. Right now, they're just going through the derivation.
Looking for errors in those equations.
All right, I've made it through the abstract, I'll admit. But I saw the great video, which we will post a link to, that Caltech put out with you guys, which is pretty impressive, I think.
There are a lot of resources for explaining what we were really saying and being able to visualize, which I think is the important thing, visualize what's actually happening in the outer solar system. So those are really good things to take a look at.
The other thing that I want to thank you for is exactly what you've been talking about, the excitement that has been generated, because anything that draws this kind of attention to real science has got to be good, right?
I think it's great. I mean, I know that people love planets, people love the solar system, maybe more so than Constantine. I was pretty convinced that when we put this paper out, people would be pretty excited about the possibility of a real ninth planet out there. So it's always good to see this much attention to actual science and solar system instead of the usual things that are in the news.
Well, I'll tell you, it's been good for business at the Planetary Society. So
this is, we'll be taking kickbacks sometimes.
That was already in the mail. if it's not there, what else might have generated the data and the analysis that you guys have done?
Nothing.
Mm. Well, you know, realistically.
I'm pretty serious about that. So,
The outer solar system would have, I mean, we'd have to put it on trial. It would have some serious explaining to do if Planet Nine's not there. I mean, look, in the end, we have the sort of theoretical evidence for its existence is threefold. It's mm-hmm. the alignment of the orbits, right? The physical kind of clustering of them in the same overall perihelion direction and plane. It is the fact that orbits like Sedna, you know, these orbits of KBOs that are detached from Neptune exist.
Sedna, I've heard of it. Yeah. Somewhere.
There's this character who...
it's kind of fun that Sedna was the first clue that something is out there, and it's finally part of the story. I've been trying to understand what caused Sedna's odd orbit ever since its discovery back in 2003, and I think we're finally there. This has been the most fun project I've ever worked on. I mean, hard to say that it's more fun than, you know, going off and discovering things like Eris's and Sedna's, but that as a contained project where you just sit down and it's also one where I have not worked as closely and as hard with someone else until now either. It's actually just been really super fun.
Mike Brown and Constantine Batygin have much more to tell us about their evidence for Planet Nine and possibly other distant worlds. This is Planetary Radio.
This is Robert Picardo. I've been a member of the Planetary Society since my Star Trek Voyager days. You may have even heard me on several episodes of Planetary Radio. Now I'm proud to be the newest member of the Board of Directors. I'll be able to do even more to help the Society achieve its goals for space exploration across our solar system and beyond. You can join me in this exciting quest. The journey starts at planetary.org. I'll see you there.
Do you know what your favorite presidential candidate thinks about space exploration? Hi, I'm Casey Dreyer, the Planetary Society's Director of Space Policy. You can learn that answer, and what all the other candidates think, at planetary.org/election2016. You know what? We could use your help. If you find anything we've missed, you can let us know. It's all at planetary.org/election2016. Thank you.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. Mike Brown and Constantine Batygin are researchers and faculty members at Caltech in Pasadena, California. Together, over the course of at least a year, they assembled strong evidence for a ninth planet circling the Sun, one that is probably 10 times as massive as Earth, and that influences the orbits of many other objects in distant reaches of our solar system. Constantine is the theorist, Mike is the observational astronomer, but the line between them is far less distinct than those titles may indicate. By the way, there's a bonus 20 more minutes of our conversation in the online version of this week's show that you can get to from planetary.org/radio. How much have you narrowed down where you and others are looking for this world?
We've done a remarkably good job of narrowing down where it should be. So we know the orbit. We know the orbit moderately well. We can tell that it's tilted by about 30 degrees to the plane of the solar system. We can tell where its perihelion is, where it comes closest. We know how close that perihelion distance is. We don't know as well where its furthest distance from the sun is, because it doesn't do much at its furthest distance, but we have some constraints on it there. And from all of that, we can make a plot of the sky, of where in the sky it would be, how bright it would be, and who's already looked and would have found it if it were in that area of the sky. And we can rule out much of the sky and see where to look. There's a little patch in the southern hemisphere that still needs to be looked at, where it could be quite bright. But most of the patches that we need to look at are up in the north, sort of in the region of Orion and Taurus, actually.
Mm-hmm. I could even find those.
Yeah, it's a good place to be.
Well, I can find Orion.
Or it's right next door. I'll show it to you.
Although I suspect my little 8-inch Celestron is not going to be much help. Are you now actively using that big system, the Subaru?
So the Subaru telescope really will be the right telescope to use for this, because for two reasons. One is it's in the northern hemisphere. And Subaru is the biggest telescope in the world that has a very wide field of view camera on it. Mm-hmm. So if you want to cover large areas of the sky, Subaru is where you want to be. Or you want to cover large areas of the sky and see faint objects, which is where we think it is at its furthest from the sun, and it's pretty faint. So we need that big telescope.
So what do you say? Just go, Mike, go. Find it.
Yeah. I mean, that's right. I was just like, you know, we talked about bopping each other with pencils. That's my job now. You know, I'm just like,
well, how come you haven't found it yet? So Constantine actually came up to the Subaru telescope last time we were up there when we first were looking at it. So it was his first time to Mauna Kea.
It was my first time to the top of Mauna Kea.
First time to the top of Mauna Kea.
Yeah. It was an incredible experience.
I got just one more, and it's from my colleague Emily Lakdawala. You both know her. Would you be surprised to find even more worlds, big ones out there in these far reaches of the solar system? Mike, I remember once, this is quite a while ago, you said you didn't think so, but then a few months ago you said stay tuned, and now here we are.
When we had discovered Eris and Sedna and all these other big guys in the Kuiper Belt, we'd done a pretty good survey of the outer solar system. It was pretty clear that there's nothing large in the immediate vicinity past the Kuiper Belt. When it got down to only 8 planets, many people would ask me, are there any more? And I said, no. I said, I think this is it for planets in the solar system. And it certainly was it for planets in this sort of traditional circular orbits of where everything formed. And I just had not really anticipated that something else could be out there at all. So I'm surprised to be sitting here saying, yes, there is even a 9th one out there. 10th one? I don't know. What do you think? You think there are more?
Well, the answer is there's no evidence for planet number 10 at the moment.
But
there was also no evidence for planet 9 10 years ago, right? It's only now that...
3 years ago.
Yeah. It's only now that the observational search revealed, is sort of only now beginning to unveil this cluster of objects that's for the first time pointing to the existence of Planet 9. So when we talk about scale, you know, we kind of tend to think, okay, 30 AU is really big, right? It's like, makes sense that that's the end of the solar system. Now, what if there's some object at hundreds of AU? It's like, wow, that's really big. But suppose we were creatures living in a solar system hosted by some other sun-like star, and our solar system was Kepler-11. Right, then we would say, wow, Mercury is like really, that. Really far away, right? And, you know, talk about, you know, Neptune's, I mean, the thing is way, way far away. And then there are systems like, I don't know, I forget the license plate, but I think it was KOI 500 that have like 4 planets with orbital periods all smaller than a day, right? So these are just totally packed. So when it comes to astrophysical scale, I think, you know, our intuition is set by the solar system that we live in. At the same time, the gravitational influence of the sun extends out to, I don't know, 100,000 AU. There's no a priori reason to say that it's implausible that there objects with semi-major axes of 10,000 AU, you know, 20,000 AU. Why not?
It's interesting, though, that something with 10 or 20,000 AU would be a very different sort of beast, because those orbits change a lot over time. When you're that far away, you start to be affected by the galactic tide, by passing stars, by moving through giant molecular clouds. All these things can really affect you greatly. So Planet Nine is close to the edge of what you can have as a long-term stable member of our solar system. I think it's good that there might be one, and that we leave it for our kids to discover, because we are not going to get there anytime soon.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I'm planning to live on as a cyborg forever. already got a Fitbit.
Good reason to hope for the singularity. And I like that phrase, Bayesian biases. I think I'll remember that. And I'll remember this conversation. Thank you, gentlemen. It has really been a tremendous pleasure. Good luck in the search.
Thanks, Matt. We're working hard.
Mike Brown is the best-selling author of How I Killed Pluto and Why It Had It Coming. He's also the Richard and Barbara Rosenberg Professor of Planetary Astronomy at the California Institute of Technology, Caltech. He's been on the faculty here for about 20 years and was recently awarded the Richard P. Feynman Award for Outstanding Teaching. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
What a cool bit of legacy.
Yeah, I like
that
one.
He's been in on the discovery of more trans-Neptunian objects than any other human being.
Oh, that's not true.
Who is?
I have discovered a lot of the big, bright ones.
Yeah.
But there are surveys that have found a lot of the fainter ones.
He has been in on the discovery of more of the big, bright trans-Neptunian objects than any other human being. He blogs now and then at MikeBrownsPlanets.com. Constantine Batygin is an assistant professor of planetary science at Caltech, where he does much more than discover new worlds. He's fascinated by the challenges involved with understanding how our and other solar systems formed and by what's going on in planetary atmospheres and deep inside these worlds. His band, The Seventh Season, last recorded an album in 2007, but he told me before the recorder turned on, they're still going. And that's their tune, Liquid Water, playing us into this week's edition of What's Up with Bruce Betts, so rock on. Everything just seems to fade out. Liquid water and the dark shade of your skin. There's nothing left in me to be found. But memories of the lies that might have seen. Everything just seems to fade. Time for Bruce Betts and another edition of What's Up. He's the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society. Right now at planetary.org and in the RSS feed where some people get this show is a conversation with you and Jason Davis, a light sail update.
It's brilliant.
Yeah.
Or at least Jason's part is.
I have no argument. I thought you were both great, and it's really fascinating. Things are cooking with light sails, so people can check that out if they're interested in hearing about the status of that project. What's up in the night sky?
Hey, if you go out there quickly, you still might catch 5 naked eye planets in one view in the pre-dawn, although Mercury is going to be getting tougher, getting lower in the pre-dawn east, but from the pre-dawn east across towards the west, we have Mercury, super bright Venus, yellowish Saturn, reddish Mars, and very bright Jupiter. Jupiter also rising in the 9 to 10 o'clock p.m. time frame, so you can check it out in the east in the evening sky if you want. We move on to this week in space history. It was 15 years ago that an orbiter became a lander when Near Shoemaker spacecraft landed on the asteroid Eros, designed to orbit, and it did, and had a successful mission. But then they thought, hey, what the heck? Let's see if we can set it down on the surface. And by gosh, it kept working.
We're going to make history here, small-time planetary radio history. For the very first time, we are going to have a random space fact, not just introduced by a celebrity, but a celebrity-provided random space fact. In fact, 2 celebrities. And here they are.
Hi, Bruce. This is Constantine Batygin.
This is Mike Brown. And I have a random space fact.
Oh, boy.
You ready?
Yeah.
Okay. So you know that Eris is more massive than Pluto. Eris is the large Kuiper Belt object out there, more massive. Do you know how much more massive Eris is than Pluto?
I'm going to go with somewhere between a factor of 1 to a few. Like
it is,
maybe 3.
If you took Pluto and you added the entire asteroid belt, you'd get to the mass of Eris.
So basically what you're saying is that not that much more massive than
Pluto. Not a bad random space fact, is it?
No, that's very entertaining and also emphasizes that indeed there's not a lot of mass, even though there are a million objects in the asteroid belt. They're awfully small.
We can go on to the contest.
We played one of my favorite games, Where in the Solar System? And I asked you, where in the solar system is Anthony Patera? Although I said it Patera, but apparently Patera is a better pronunciation.
There were many, many responses. Probably two-thirds of those responses mentioned, in addition to the Anthony Patera or Patera that you were looking for, a certain gentleman. Well, let's hear from him.
I am Anthony Patera, a professor at MIT. I am very pleased to serve as a piece of planetary trivia. Now, please ask your listeners to stop Googling me.
Thank you so much, Professor Patera, the Ford Professor of Engineering in Mechanical Engineering. He's the co-director of the Center for Computational Engineering at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And yes, we're sending him a Planetary Radio t-shirt.
Yeah, I really just meant the feature on Venus. I'm sorry for all that unfortunate Googling that occurred.
Let me read you this from Dave Fairchild in Shawnee, Kansas. You ask, where is Tony Patera? He's not on the French Riviera. I guess I would say he's in Cambridge, MA, as an MIT engineer, Chera.
I had no idea what I was getting us into.
Indeed, our winner, though, who did not tell us about the MIT professor, Andreas Herzig. Andreas Herzig in Cologne, Germany, is this week's winner, I believe. He said, Anthony Patera, or Patera, is a crater-like feature on the northern hemisphere of Venus. Even though the name is a male name, it's actually named after a famous woman, and I bet you know who it is.
Susan B. Anthony, American suffragette. As with almost all features on Venus, are named after women.
And that's why we got the suggestion from Elizabeth Garcia in Ukiah, California, that we should go out of this with David Bowie's Suffragette City. Suffragette Crater.
Patera, it's a shallow bowl-like feature named after shallow bowl-like saucers of the Romans.
Professor Patero, he thought it was from the Latin, but couldn't figure out whether it was Latin or Greek. But so you've resolved that for us as well.
There's your little planetary lesson.
Well, congratulations, Andreas. We are going to send you that fabulous prize package, a Planetary Radio t-shirt, a 200-point iTelescope.net astronomy account for use of that nonprofit network of telescopes all over the world, and for one of the last times, a set of Year in Space wall and desk calendars that you can see at yearinspace.com. We will keep that package alive one more time for the question that you're about to give us.
What was famous astronomer Herschel? What was Herschel's first and middle names? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
Ooh, that could be tricky for reasons I won't go into. You'll need to get that to us by the 16th. That would be Tuesday, February 16th at 8 a.m. Pacific time. Thank you. This has been fun.
It has indeed. All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think about old oil paintings. Thank you, and good night.
On Velvet, it's always fun to talk with Bruce Bett. He's the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society and the Project Manager for LightSail. There's that conversation waiting for you to hear about the status of that mission. Bruce, though, joins us every week here for What's Up. Next week, our exclusive interview with the band OK Go. Wait till you see their new video. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its worldly members. Daniel Gunn is our associate producer. Josh Doyle created the theme music. I'm Matt Kaplan. Clear skies.